This is All In. I'm Jeannie Lindsay, filling in today for Miriam Sobe. Some childcare providers have struggled to keep their doors open during the pandemic, with some experiencing staffing shortages and others in need of more funding. Today, we'll talk about some of the challenges Indiana's childcare providers are dealing with right now, how some problems were worsened by the pandemic, and what's being done to help. We're joined now by Nicole Norvell, director of the Indiana Office of Early Childhood and Out-of-School Learning, and Debbie DeBruin, president and CEO of Right Steps Child Development Centers. Nicole, I want to start with you. Can you start out by telling us about some of the biggest problems childcare providers are dealing with right now?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. I think what we keep hearing from our childcare operators across the state is really staffing is their biggest issue at this time. So finding individuals who have a passion and desire to work in childcare, who the hours make sense for their families, understanding that sometimes those hours are not as flexible as they are in other industries, and really struggling with the amount of pay that typically childcare staff have earned and how to be competitive in the market. I think this was an issue prior to COVID, but certainly one that's been exacerbated since.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about some of the issues that maybe providers are dealing with now that predate COVID in addition to staffing?
So certainly, you know, I think childcare is expensive, right? We know that providing high quality care does cost a lot, but sometimes families can't afford to pay that. So I think the difference in those two things was certainly an issue pre-COVID, probably more so now, because providers have been asked to do some things differently that have definitely added cost. So for example, the sharing of materials or combining classrooms in the morning and afternoon during pickup and drop off so that you had enough staff to cover those things we've asked providers to not do anymore to try to minimize the amount of spread that has occurred. And with that then comes extra costs, which they oftentimes don't want to pass on to parents, which we appreciate, but then they are left trying to figure out how to make all of that work. And again, you know, those things were an issue pre-COVID, but certainly I think have been made worse since that time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Debbie, I want to talk with you about some of the biggest challenges for Right Steps centers before the pandemic. What were some of the things that Right Steps was dealing with, and how did those challenges change when COVID-19 entered the scene?
Well, one of the things that we really were focusing on prior to COVID arriving is expanding the number of children that we could serve. And I think there was quite a focus statewide, and we have been in the mix of all of that. We actually took over the operation of a center that was really struggling in Remington, Indiana in January of 2020, and then COVID hit in March of 2020. Once that happened, everything has changed tremendously for us from the moment a family arrives in the morning, because we don't allow anyone in our building right now, as Nicole said earlier, just to prevent as much as we possibly can the spread of COVID. All throughout the day, individualizing toys, individualizing meals instead of serving family style, just the way in which we operate has completely changed and continues to do so really day by day and week by week, even to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Especially with sort of the unexpected nature of how the pandemic has evolved over time. So, Nicole, I want to kind of gauge how providers are doing right now, obviously working with FSSA at the state level. What can you tell me about the current state of childcare and early learning? I mean, how are providers doing kind of generally speaking?
Well, first, I would say I think our childcare providers across the state deserve just massive kudos. They are some of the hardest working, strongest people that you're going to find. I think they have, you know, remained open as much as possible during the last 18 months, even though that sometimes meant putting themselves and their staff in danger in terms of getting COVID. And so they certainly deserve just a huge amount of credit. I think they also are adapting really well. So to Debbie's points, the things that they used to always do, doing them differently, they're doing a great job of thinking through how to do those things in a way that still respects the rights of parents and helps parents feel comfortable, but also trying to keep kids safe. You know, we have been really fortunate in this state to not lose a lot of childcare providers over the last 18 months, and not all states have seen that. We certainly have lost capacity in terms of, you know, providers who have to close classrooms and sometimes are not able to reopen those yet because they are not able to find staff. But overarchingly, I think we have fared fairly well in comparison to some of the states that surround us.
In this moment in time, you know, where we are in the pandemic in this year, are you seeing improvements? Are we hearing about, you know, things getting better? What is the path that we're on in this moment?
Yeah, we definitely are seeing things get better. I think, you know, we are asking our child cares to tell us every month information about their enrollment, how many teaching positions they're looking for, those kinds of things. And we are seeing that data point get better. Now, certainly there are parts of the state where it's not rising as quickly as others. And some of that has to do with the industries and those communities and whether or not those industries have gone back to a pre-pandemic work environment or not. That certainly has an impact on the demand for childcare. But we are seeing, you know, improvements. We're seeing less teaching positions open and more seats being filled. We certainly still have a pretty large need for infant and toddler care. That is something that has not rebounded quite as quickly, and an area that we will continue to focus on a great deal here in the coming months.
So a little bit of optimism and hope on the horizon, which is always good to hear in times like these. So, Debbie, I wanted to hear from you. Did you have any concerns about Right Steps centers having to close? I mean, as Nicole was mentioning, there have been some that have closed temporarily. You know, and when the pandemic started, so many people, businesses, you know, were sort of having to close their doors. Was that ever a concern for Right Steps?
Well, certainly when it began in March and with all of the unknowns, we didn't have any idea none of us understood what we were all facing. So sure, we weren't certain we were going to be able to stay open. We weren't certain that we weren't going to be locked down like everyone else, but we also knew that we had to take care of essential workers and their families particularly. So there never was any intention on our part to close. And fortunately, although we have been hit throughout the last 18 months with COVID, and we have had to close a center, we have had to close classrooms, we have had staff and families who've had to quarantine, but we've managed to work through that, and we have stayed open the entire time.
Yeah. And how was that possible? What were some of the things that made that a possibility for Right Steps?
Well, one of the first things I want to say is the state of Indiana, through different funding streams, immediately jumped to our rescue because, as Nicole mentioned earlier, all of a sudden we were facing all of these costs that weren't normally budgeted to keep our children in our care, our staff safe, our families safe. And that was a tremendous expense. So immediately those funds became available to all of us who were open and licensed. So we took advantage of that. And just through guidance from the state also, they've provided regular guidance to us of things that we should and should not do, can and can't do. We've also communicated very, very regularly with our families and also certainly our staff. The entire environment has changed. So, you know, it's difficult when we don't allow anyone into our centers, when our administrative team used to spend a tremendous amount of time in our centers to provide that support. You know, we literally have not been allowing anyone in those centers. So all of that has been just a very different way of doing business. But we've had enough support around us and different funding streams that have come through, and that's been very helpful.
So Nicole, one of the issues that was brought up and that a lot of childcare providers I've talked to and that you mentioned is staffing. So can you talk a little bit about, I guess, what makes staffing such a challenge for providers to manage, and especially now?
Well, certainly, you know, I think there are multiple things at play here. So one is, you know, it's not a job that you can do from home. And as we are seeing in a lot of industries, we have a workforce who I think realized some of the benefits potentially of being able to work from home and what that meant for them from a family perspective or just a, you know, personal perspective. This is not one of those jobs. We are definitely front facing and with children all day long. I think the other is, you know, historically, childcare has not been a high wage field. And I think as the workforce has changed and has become just really competitive here in the last several months, we're finding that our childcare operators are likely going to have to increase what they pay staff in order to be competitive with other service industries. And I think that piece, too, is a really big change. It also means that our provider base has to probably change the way that they are looking at their business model. And that is not something that can be done overnight. And we know some of them need some help thinking through how to maybe align their revenue and expenses differently to be able to pay staff a different wage. So, I mean, I think there are a great number of issues that contribute to this, but I certainly believe that the field is ready for that challenge and they're doing a good job of trying to think differently so that they can address the workforce issue.
And Debbie, we have about 90 seconds before we go to our first break, but can you tell me about some of the staffing issues at Right Steps or what you've done to retain staff?
90 seconds. Boy, we've done a lot. One of the main things we've done two rounds of hero pay with funds that have come in, which is just retention pay to say thank you to our heroes who are also essential workers. Now, recently, and I can talk more about this after the break, but we are getting ready to add an employee assistance program November 1st. So we're trying to do everything we can really to surround our staff with as much support as we possibly can.
Yeah, and especially with funding and pay and, you know, people needing to pay their bills still, that's definitely a critical piece here. So we will be going back. We'll come right back after our quick break. We're talking about the challenges childcare providers are facing right now and what's being done to keep their doors open. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Jeannie Lindsay. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jeannie Lindsay, filling in today for Miriam Sobe. The childcare industry took a hit at the start of the pandemic, with some providers having to close their doors and others seeing staffing shortages. To talk about it, we're joined by Nicole Norvell, director of the Indiana Office of Early Childhood and Out-of-School Learning, and Debbie DeBruin, president and CEO of Right Steps Child Development Centers. Nicole, you were saying before the break that we've seen providers close during the pandemic. I'm wondering how much you can tell us about how many we've seen and how many of those are temporary versus, you know, maybe permanent or indefinite.
Yeah, so when we look at our data in terms of total number of providers we had pre-COVID and what we have to now, it's really about the same. So we've not lost capacity in terms of total number of programs because we have also had programs open up in the last several months who maybe weren't in existence before. We do see a slight decline, though, in the total number of what we would call seats or number of kids that can be served in programs. And again, that goes back to some programs having to make difficult decisions about not serving as many children as they did pre-pandemic. But overarchingly, our numbers look to be about the same as they were prior to COVID-19.
And so, Debbie, I know you were saying earlier that there have been some temporary closures with Right Steps. Can you talk a little bit about how those have affected families and staff, especially because, you know, the pandemic has been so unpredictable. And with, you know, some of these closures, you know, they're a little bit harder to predict. So can you talk a little bit about how these closures have affected families and staff who need that stability for care, but also for, you know, employment?
Well, I can address staffing first. When our staff were forced to leave, to go into quarantine, or if they were exposed for any reason, or we had to close an entire classroom, or even in the event we had to close an entire center, we continued to pay staff through all of this. So they did not lose any wages. And that was a huge priority for us because now we're creating an entirely different problem if we're not paying our staff. So that's first. Families, that was a lot tougher. It's really hard when we had to call families and say, we just had someone that tested positive for COVID, whether it was in the classroom, a teacher, a couple of circumstances, it was a child, or even a parent. There was no notice. And so those parents had to abruptly leave and come and get their child and go into quarantine. We tried to provide some resources. There were a couple of circumstances that we even assisted a couple of families with some groceries and some of those emergency things that we could do. I was very fortunate. Our board set aside $5,000 when all of this started to help our families in the event that they really hit some roadblock that was going to cause their family not to eat or care or housing, whatever it was. And so we used some of those funds that were dedicated. But, you know, it's just been a very, very trying time. And we've just kind of addressed it as we've gone along, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. And with limited funding and limited people power, you know, sometimes finding those resources is even more difficult when everyone's kind of feeling that pressure. So Nicole, I wanted to pivot a little bit and talk about funding. For those who don't know, can you talk a little bit about how childcare providers typically receive funding? I mean, how does that work?
Sure. So most childcare providers have various funding streams. So certainly one is from parents who are paying for their child to come every week. We also have the Child Care Development Fund, which is money that comes directly to us as a state from the federal government to support low-income families, those specifically who are working or going to school to help pay for their child care. And then for four-year-olds, we also have On My Way Pre-K, which is the program that we use to help children who are lower income right in that year before kindergarten. And then many providers are also fortunate to receive some philanthropic funding from their communities in various ways. But that tends to be, you know, how providers are funded in general.
And can you speak a little bit to how funding for the industry and funding support for families has changed since COVID started? You know, what examples are there of what basically COVID-19 has prompted?
Sure. So, you know, as Debbie spoke about, we definitely tried to get money to the field very quickly, especially in those beginning months. And that funding was to be used to support their operational costs to do exactly what Debbie said, which is pay their staff and then also relieve families from payment to the provider when that was possible. We've been really fortunate to receive several investments from Congress into childcare. And so one of those allowed us to stand up the Build, Learn, Grow scholarship program, which is really aimed at any family who works in an essential field. So that covers everything from your local grocery store to bank to your first responders to all kinds of folks. So that we could also help pay for their childcare needs. And what's great about that scholarship is any income family can apply and receive some level of support. And then right now we've been really fortunate with the most recent investment from Congress to offer stabilization grants to our childcare providers. And these are funds that are directed towards them to help offset their operating costs, either those that they've already experienced or that they're currently experiencing. And the hope with those is that we allow them to be able to think about wages for their staff, to be able to think about benefits or other programs that might be a good attractor to the field, and really help them begin to get back to where they were pre-pandemic. And so, you know, again, I really would say we've been very fortunate, like all states, to have these investments from Congress to be able to try to address some of these needs.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Debbie, looking to, you know, the management side of all of this, I'm curious, you know, what are some of the typical responses or strategies in responding to some of the funding gaps that have existed? And I'd love to talk with you about some of the funding that Right Steps has received. But, you know, before that, what are some of the strategies to address these gaps as they've existed in the past and you know, continue through the pandemic?
Well, we're very fortunate in Tippecanoe County because we are a United Way agency in Tippecanoe County, and we actually received just over $500,000 And much of that money goes to help our, what I would call our working poor families. So those families that don't necessarily qualify for child care assistance funds, but they really can't afford high quality care. And so we utilize a great deal of that money to help subsidize those families so that they can send their child or children to a high quality program such as Right Steps. So that's been a big, big kudos for United Way that they've continued to do that and did that even prior to the pandemic. Post-pandemic, as Nicole and I have both mentioned, you know, Congress has really been very generous, and we have received a lot of money in the last 18 months to help us stay stable through the pandemic and absorb all the additional costs. But now with these new funds, these stabilization funds, we're actually going to be able to look to the future. And one of the things I think that's difficult, and in this country, for some reason, we really look at education beginning at age 5 as far as funding, when really education begins at birth. And so we've always kind of been the stepchild of the educational system with lower wages, but still a lot of required credentials, associate degrees, CDAs, bachelor degrees. Some of our staff have master's degrees. So our goal right now is to utilize some of these funds that are coming in now through the stabilization process to put a long-term strategic plan to move our funding of staff and our staff positions up to something that would be comparable to the elementary school entry-level teacher. And that's our goal. But we can't do something rash when we won't have money to sustain that for years to come. So I'm really excited for us to start focusing on that long-term plan. And I think that's what, Nicole, the state of Indiana is really wanting us to do.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit more about the grant funds that Right Steps has received? I know you and I have spoken in the past about, you know, collaborating with other centers to manage some of the business side of things to ease some of the pressure there. So can you talk a little bit about what grant funds have been received, you know, made possible because of Congress's action and what sort of the vision is moving forward with those?
Sure. When the pandemic started, we had just, as I mentioned earlier, we had just taken over the day-to-day operation and management of the Growing Patch Center in Remington, Indiana. 70—that's a 70-seat center. They had slipped from a high level to all the way down to a level one. They had the local support funding to get the building open and get staff initially hired, but unfortunately they didn't have the expertise and the manpower to sustain it. So that began this process of us looking at maybe what if we provided you with that day-to-day management. And so we did. 2 months before the pandemic hit, we took over that operation. Well, through that process, we then began talking to another rural county, Newton County, and we actually opened a center there in October of last year, which was smack dab in the middle of the second surge of the pandemic. But because it's needed and because families needed the care and there was no quality care there other than a Head Start program that families had to be eligible for, it was a priority for us to get that open. And so we did. Thirdly, then we opened an additional center here in Tippecanoe County in March, again, through the pandemic. And that goes back to adding capacity and how important that is. Really, we have so many children in Indiana that do not have available care that has to continue to be our priority, pandemic or not.
Right, right. Expanding the access to more families.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So, Nicole, speaking of access and you know, providers staying open and stabilization, can you talk a little bit about the stabilization grant program and the price tag that comes with it? I'm just curious, I guess, what you make of this program and how it's designed to support providers.
Yeah, so the program is really there for any provider who is licensed or registered or regulated by our office, which includes about 3,400 providers across the state of Indiana. And essentially, those programs had to be open by March 11th of 2021. And that was just a piece that Congress put into that legislation. But that's really, that's great. I mean, we have, again, we've got about 3,400 programs who meet that criteria. Once they apply for that funding, it's deposited into their bank accounts with an approved application within 3 weeks. So the goal is to get them the funding very quickly. And there are certain ways they can use those funds. So there are some allowable expenses, things like staffing, certainly, you know, if you pay rent or mortgage, your food, general operating expenses. But to Debbie's point, the hope is that programs will really start to think about long-term strategic plans. So not only making up for, you know, funding deficits they may have had, but how they use this fund to really think differently. We're just in our first round, so opened up the application October 6th. And to date, we've had over 24 applications for awarding about $80.6 million, which is great. We'll have another round come January, and we'll keep doing that until the funds are totally gone.
And this program, the stabilization program, the amount that's available with it, it's about $500 million with a B. I mean, how does this compare to previous grants or opportunities? I mean, how big of a deal is that much money, you know, for providers to use that are in these situations?
Yeah, it's a huge deal. So you are right. We have over $500 million to dedicate to this effort. And you know, as far back as we can tell, you know, I don't know that there's ever been this kind of investment in early learning. And so I think it gives everyone a really wonderful opportunity to think about how to use this, not as just a one-time investment, but really as a way to help us transform what we do in early learning and to really show that with the right investments, the difference that we can make for children and families is significant.
And Debbie, in your position and with all of the centers that you work with, what does it mean to see more attention and this amount of funding brought to early childhood education? And I'm curious, kind of to build on that, what you wish more people understood about this industry, this field?
Great question. Boy, first of all, the one thing I want to say is it has... The last year and a half with COVID, certainly for all of us, every single human being alive, has been just a nightmare. But one of the blessings that we have had in early childhood education has been these funds that have come in to help us really take a look at things long term, whether it is us trying to help our rural counties open a center and operate it and share some of those costs. So we've gotten that funding. The stabilization money that Nicole is talking about is just absolutely amazing. It is like nothing I don't think any of us ever thought we would be able to sit down and have a strategic plan about, honestly. You know, with all of our centers have already applied for the first round of funding. I'm assuming we'll be getting that in the next couple of weeks. So that's going to be step one in our planning. The thing that maybe people don't understand that you had asked, it is so expensive to take care of young learners in a high quality environment. It costs $12,000, $13,000, $14,000, $15,000 a year. To do it right and to do it at a high quality with a curriculum, with all the things that really are important to prepare children to enter kindergarten. So it's not that we're wanting to charge families a lot of money. You're not going to make money in early childhood education if you do it right. So that's one thing I don't think people really understand is just how expensive it truly is. And it depends on the age of a child. Just one small example, we're only allowed to have, and rightfully so, 8 infants in a classroom. And we need to have 3 staff in there. And that's not including, you know, the center director or the cook or even our office staff that helps support. So it's just a very, very expensive endeavor if we do it right. But why would we not do it right when children are our greatest asset?
Right. It's trying to find that balance between the quality and the safety, but also the expenses and the people power that are required to make sure that those other pieces of the puzzle come together. We are going to take another break. We're talking to leaders in Indiana's childcare industry to learn about the challenges they're facing during the pandemic and what's being done now. If you have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Jeannie Lindsay. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jeannie Lindsay, filling in today for Miriam Sobe. Back now to our discussion on Indiana's childcare industry during the pandemic and what's being done to help service providers across the state keep their doors open. And as always, we love to hear your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name, where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. We're joined by Nicole Norvell, director of the Indiana Office of Early Childhood and Out-of-School Learning, and Debbie DeBruin, president and CEO of Right Steps Child Development Centers. So, Nicole, we've talked quite a bit about congressional funding, pandemic-related relief. I'm curious, from your perspective at the state level, what sort of things are you watching the federal government on in terms of further support for early childhood education? I'm curious if there's any changes that you're keeping eyes on or looking out for.
We're certainly looking at bills, you know, that are sitting in Congress today related to early childhood. We always keep an eye on those just because we want to be sure we are prepared. I think we're also really looking to our federal partners for continued guidance around, one, how to best use these funds, but two, you know, as it relates to COVID, understanding that vaccines are not yet available for children in most of our child care programs, you know, understanding what are all the safety precautions we need to continue to take, I think has just been a really important partnership.
So one of the things I wanted to explore a little bit more is sort of the rural-urban divide. So, Debbie, I wanted to speak with you about this. You work with providers in rural counties. Can you tell us about some of the experiences or different circumstances that differ? I mean, what is it like running a program in some of the more rural parts of the state?
Oh, you know what? It's so much fun because they just are so appreciative of all of the back end things that we're doing to assist. I think one of the most incredible things about our more rural counties is they have individuals that know that early childhood education needs should be a priority for their community. They even are really tremendous at raising the funds, like I said earlier, to get the building built, initially to get staffing underway. But then they run into lots of problems, like they don't really understand. It's a very complicated business from the business end. So when Nicole talked about all the different funding streams that could potentially fund one child or a family or however, you know, those have to be managed and they have to be recorded and they have to be journaled and audited and claimed. And so just from that perspective, it's really hard. A lot of times, too, they don't have the expertise living in the community to provide all of the expertise and the what's needed as far as really developing a high quality, in our case, nationally accredited early childhood center. So we're able to do that. We've taken over all of their HR and management operations. And then we basically bill the community once a month. They still own it. It's theirs locally. We just do the day-to-day management and operation of it. So it's really ended up being a wonderful partnership, both in Remington and in Goodland, and now in the first part of 2022, we're going to be opening another center in Rensselaer with Appleseed Childhood Education, a nonprofit group that has done exactly the same thing. And we're going to come in and do the same, the day-to-day operation and management of that center as well.
Right. The rural areas come with a whole different community feel when it comes to the service provided, but also the support for it, too.
Yeah, they just don't have the access, and they don't have the number of people, and what they do have is the commitment, which if they have the commitment, then the rest of it we can work out.
Right. Well, we have a listener voicemail from Jerome who has a couple questions about early childhood education. Let's listen.
Yes, this is Jerome Eckel from Evansville, Indiana, and I'm calling about childcare and your guest's opinion about the need for Indiana to change its education support system to include preschool along with K-12 education. Secondly, I'd like to know your guest's opinion about the federal legislation that's currently pending that supports early childhood education. Thank you.
So, Nicole, would you like to start?
Sure. So I think in reference to his first question about whether or not we should be kind of all one big system, you know, here's what I would say, which is I agree wholeheartedly with Debbie that learning begins at birth. I mean, what we now know about the way children and their brains develop in that birth to five continuum, we understand that children are learning more in that time than they are in almost any other time. Their brain is developing faster, and it really sets the stage for what should happen for them in later life. What I would tell you, though, is early childhood education is very different than K-12 education. So if you walked into one of Debbie's centers, you're not going to see children sitting at desk facing forward, learning in that way. You're going to see them at various interactive play stations, them doing different things with their hands and their senses and learning in ways that is very different. So I think we always want to be really thoughtful about how we think about education and just understanding that based on the development of the child, it should look different. And how do we not try to make it all the same? I think that's really important. In terms of his second question about what Congress is doing, we certainly are watching that very closely. What I would say is I have been in government long enough to know that we probably shouldn't plan for anything until the bill is all the way done. It'll change a lot between now and then. But I do think what's really exciting is that we see a continued focus and realization that early childhood education is important and access to it for parents is really important for not only them and their children, but really for economic recovery. And so regardless, I think it's super exciting to see that people are interested in taking steps to really make the system better.
Yeah. And Debbie, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
Boy, I just absolutely agree with her. I really do. And I do think one of the points that she made, that birth to five learning is so different. And I think that's so compelling what she said, but it's so critical for the overall development of the person. And I do love that our high quality providers are able to do that. And I don't know that it needs to be in a school setting. I just think it needs to be paid as closely attention and funded as appropriately as all education.
Yeah. And Nicole, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about as well, is sort of the perception of early childhood education and how that sort of changed over time. I'm curious from your perspective, what sort of things that you have changed about the way you talk about it or encouraged others in terms of the way that they talk about this early learning childcare space to really hone in and make clear the educational side of it, in addition to having care for families?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, I think even the terminology that's used in the field today is really different than it was before. So even today, the three of us are talking about early childhood education. We're not saying daycare, certainly not saying babysitting. And I think, you know, just over the course of the history of the field, we're trying to ensure that even the way we refer to it, we're articulating what's happening in that environment. I think that that's just really important. You know, I think the other piece is, the state deserves a lot of credit from those who were strong advocates and to our state legislature for On My Way Pre-K. And really, not just saying that there was a focus on pre-K, but a focus on high quality pre-K. And I think because of that, we've been able to really educate our communities about why early learning is important, not just in that pre-K year, but for that child's entire experience. And I think as we continue to move forward, it will take all of us, you know, our advocates, our community leaders, our state leaders, to help everyone understand the importance of what's happening in those environments every day.
And Debbie, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, with the talk a lot about funding support and, you know, the way that things have changed during the pandemic, I'm curious from your perspective, what more needs to happen other than funding, you know, looking ahead to sustain this industry, to, you know, ensure consistency for families? I'm curious what sort of things, you know, you would suggest or would like to see change outside of funding levels.
Then I guess number one, I just would like for every single solitary child that is birthed to five to have some sort of experience before they start school, some kind of curriculum-based early learning experience, whether it's a high-quality home provider or a high-quality center. It really, that part really doesn't matter. But what really does matter is all of the things that we teach. Even we begin with our infants. We have a curriculum for our infants. A lot of people don't realize that, but we do. Everything we do has a purpose. So I really think that mindset, and we just don't yet have the capacity. I mean, we talk a lot about it. And I think, you know, since I've been at Right Steps for the last 4 years, that's really all I've heard from the state is capacity and quality. And I could not agree more with that. I do think funding is a critical piece of that. And we have spent a lot of time talking about that and how exciting that we're talking about it in a positive light right now, which is wonderful. And then I, you know, just really recognizing the efforts of our staff that work with these little ones every single day, day in and day out, and the qualifications and the trainings and all of the things that are required of them. A true recognition of them, I think, is certainly warranted.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's similar to, I cover education, and we've been hearing a lot about K-12 teachers, but childcare staff and people who provide this essential service, you know, it's important to recognize and talk about them as well. Nicole, I'm curious what you see as maybe some of the greatest needs for how the structure of childcare resources and services, you know, at the state or policy level, what sort of things you envision as a need to sustain the industry moving forward or improve it, given all the things that we've learned during the pandemic? What are some things that stand out to you outside of funding?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of work to do. So, you know, I think funding is really important, but I also think the infrastructure of the funding mechanisms we have today needs some work. You know, the money really stays with that child. And while there is good to that, it's also difficult if you're a childcare provider to do a budget that is changing on you all the time. And so the infrastructure, I think, of the way that we approach it is definitely something that we will be working towards changing. We also need to look at how we give our early childhood education teachers greater access to higher education, to, you know, career pathways that make sense for them in terms of, you know, what they want to do long term and how we can help them increase those competencies that they need in order to be effective with children. And we know we have a lot of work to do around diversity. We know that there are communities in this state that have less access than others. We also know that our workforce does not look like the children oftentimes that they are teaching, and we want to change that as well. So we have a lot of work to do, but really exciting things, and certainly know that the partnerships in Indiana are so strong and believe that we'll be able to accomplish a lot here over the next couple of years.
Yeah, of course. Debbie, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is sort of what changes have come to Right Steps that you see, continuing, moving forward. I know one of the things that I've heard a lot about during the pandemic is, you know, the flexibility or adaptability or, you know, things that people have learned that they do better now. So I'm curious if there's been anything that stood out to you during the pandemic that Right Steps has learned or that you have learned that you plan to carry with you forward as you continue working in this field?
Well, I thought for a long time that you can sit in an office from 8 to 5 and get nothing accomplished, or you can really work anywhere. You can work at home and be equally as productive or oftentimes more productive. So I'm happy that we're taking a look at that. I agree with that completely. In the center specifically, obviously, we're open 12 hours a day, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. So we're trying to cover 12 hours every single day. However, we are really trying to think outside of the box and look at flexibility with our teachers. And we're doing that right now. Instead of your traditional, 8-hour workday or whatever, if we can do some things like that to help families, that's our ideal. Also, more and more, even retirees that just want to come in and spend a few hours a day with our children, kind of like the schools do with their paras. We're really looking at that. So we're ever changing. And I think one of the things that has meant the most to me is really recognizing that there is a lot of stress. And I think that's in our workforce in general. Of course, I'm focusing more on our staff at Right Steps, but really paying attention to that and trying to surround our staff with resources such as like the employee assistance program that we're starting in November to really support our staff and their families in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of the whole person approach and leveraging more of that people power. Nicole, we don't have much time left, but in 45 seconds, can you talk a little bit about the resources for families?
Yes. So I would say for all families, you absolutely can start if you're looking for care at childcarefinder.in.gov. It's going to be the best place for you to start that exploration and what's available around you. There's a great route to work feature where you can type in where you live and where you work. And it's going to show you all the child cares on your route so that you can see what's most available to you. I would also say that if you're a family who works in an essential field, and please know that that definition is very broad, so don't think it doesn't include you because it might, you can go to the Build, Learn, Grow website where we have all kinds of information about scholarships that might be able to help you, programs that are accepting those scholarships and the ways that you apply.
Thanks so much, Nicole. I want to thank our guests for taking the time today. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Jeannie Lindsay. Thanks for listening. This is All In.